Today, we are going to talk about Theresa Degner. She's a disability activist, campaigner and academic from Germany. I'm not sure if either of you had heard of her before.
No, I haven't actually.
Yeah, no, I haven't either. But side note, I will say I love the way that their name is spelled, just for the audience, like Theresia. So even though it's Theresa, it looks like even fancier, you know, like Theresia. So I'm very excited to hear about their life story, just because the name itself is very interesting.
Yeah, well, she's a really great woman, and she first became involved in the women's movement and identifies as a feminist very early on. She joined her first women's group at the age of 17, actually, so she was quite young when she got involved in the women's movement. And she says that her sister was a big influence and a role model at the time, and I think that's something I can relate to anyway with sisters.
But I do not get along with my sister.
Sinead, of course you don't. I think I have you guys beat. I have four sisters. So,
wow, yeah. I didn't know that, Rebecca.
Oh, yeah, I'm the oldest of six. I have four sisters and a brother. So good on Theresa for being close with her sister.
Yeah, I think Theresa also comes from a big family. I can't remember, but I recall her saying that she's the youngest, I think, of many siblings. So yeah, her sister really, I suppose, encouraged and influenced her. But she first got involved in the disability movement in 1981, and that was the International Year of the Disabled. And this was the first time that Theresa became politically active in terms of the disability movement and in taking a stand about human rights violations, as opposed to celebrating the welfare state that I suppose this Year of the Disabled was kind of alluding to, you know. And she really believes that this year really allowed for disability campaigners to come together and mobilize in Germany, and was the start of the disability movement in Germany at the time. So yeah, I don't know, I think that's kind of interesting that there was kind of a reason for people to come together and campaign about something. I think that's often the way, and it often is allows for a space to be created. So that's quite interesting.
Yeah, definitely. And also good on Theresa, because this is before, you know, being a feminist or being a part of like the disability protections movement was cool. You know, this is much before that. And so it took, in my opinion, a lot more bravery to like attend
Absolutely.
Events like this, and also like intersectional events like this, where you have disability and feminism combined. And so she was really, it sounds like at least, she was one of the very first to have the bravery to join these movements. And I'm sure that definitely had a bit to do with her older sister influencing her.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think that within this kind of gathering, they first created a group for disabled women as well, which is really interesting. And they came together as disabled women addressing women's issues. And I suppose that was really important foundation and kind of a start to the disabled women's movement as well.
Yeah, I just know, just on Becca's point earlier about just kind of before it was cool and that kind of stuff, I think, yeah, just to kind of think of the world kind of pre-social media as well is interesting. And just I always try and, you know, even with other women I would hear of locally who were involved in, you know, feminist activities, and trying to kind of place them in a time where, yeah, it wasn't kind of the status quo, or it wasn't like a slogan on a t-shirt, you know. Like, I just think it's just so, you know, right off the bat, I think these women are just so impressive to me, or any individual who was kind of doing something, yeah, like that wasn't status quo.
Absolutely. And I feel like really privileged to have the opportunity to work with Theresa and to interview her. So it's great as well to see someone you can like really look up to as a role model yourself as well. That's really great as well. Just a little bit about what she studied. She studied law first. And she was first really interested in law because of the women's movement, actually. And she always has a really rights-based approach. And she spent some time working with women who had been in prison. And mainly this was due to reaction to maybe male violence, that they might have, you know, killed or murdered their husband or their partner, and they were put in prison for that. And she told me in the interview, seen as, you know, the only way out for these women, they were put in prison. But her job was to, I suppose, reintegrate them into society when they came out of prison. So she would work with them and go to the welfare office and do things like that. And she speaks really about how this was a really important experience and part of her life story. And she also says how this actually really encouraged her to go back to law school. She took some time out to work on this. And she said at the time the law school was actually very ableist, and also there was not many women studying law, so she really was fighting, you know, more than one discrimination in her studies. And she would often talk about the lecturers, you know, making comments on different things to do with gender and disability. Yeah, I think she was really tough to stick it out and become a professor like she is today.
Yeah. Did this all happen during her time at Berkeley, Eva?
Yeah, so actually after she graduated from her school in Germany, she went to Berkeley, California, to study anti-discrimination law. And she spoke about at the time of this time, there was very little anti-discrimination law in Germany, actually. Actually, it's quite recent, anti-discrimination law in Germany. They were very late coming to the fore with that. I think maybe only in the 2000s that they developed their anti-discrimination law. But she went to Berkeley and she studied there, and she was really introduced to human rights law. And that's when she became really interested, and she did an internship actually at the United Nations after that, and published a book on human rights and disabled people in 1995 before deciding to enter academia.
Wow. Yeah. So just from the little bit that you've told me about Teresa, I know a lot about Berkeley Law School because it's one of the top 10 programs in the United States and is really famous for anti-discrimination work, activism work. So in my head, it kind of sounds like a match made in heaven that Teresa ended up at Berkeley working on human rights and anti-discrimination law. And from the accomplishments that you've said, like interning at the UN, publishing a book, later going on into academia, it seems like that was like a really important milestone in her life.
Definitely. And I know as well, like within the disability movement, like Berkeley is a really centrist stone kind of as well. So it would be, I would love to go there and study or spend some time there at some point. But yeah, just it sounds like it really was, I suppose, the beginning of her work in the anti-discrimination law in that area.
Yeah, Berkeley is incredible. And maybe, you know, I went through the law school admissions process this past year, and maybe that's why I know a little bit more about Berkeley Law, but they waitlisted me. So if Teresa got accepted, she must have been an incredible lady.
Maybe she can give you some tips.
Yeah, I need a letter of rec from her.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, so like I suppose one of the areas she was really like spoke a lot about and worked a lot on was the debate around abortion, as it's a really contentious issue between the disability and women's movement. And I suppose Teresa was very against eugenic abortions. So that would be abortion on the grounds of disability. So it's a really, really complex situation because, you know, as disabled feminists, we really believe in the right to bodily autonomy. But I suppose there's some issues with the women's movement in and wider society in general, actually, in how they often equate disability to, you know, reasoning of an abortion or late-term abortion. And it was really, really interesting to speak to Theresa about this, who's been involved for such a long time working in this area, because it's still quite a contentious issue today and something I think we really need to do a lot more on. And I suppose just as sex isn't a determinant for abortion, I suppose people with disabilities think that disability shouldn't be either, that it's just not very, how would you say, not very inclusive, or does it like kind of, you know, does it say that the lives of a disabled person isn't worth living, and just a really open, really big philosophical debate.
I think it perpetrates kind of an ableist kind of mentality. I think it's such, like, it's such a convoluted topic, and I didn't like it. Something that I've just been reminded about just by you speaking about it, Aoife. But so were you saying that she's very much kind of like a front runner in this kind of, like,
absolutely,
and like her story is just so interesting. I love, just like, I was kind of nearly inclined to kind of just like sit back and like, I had to remind myself, oh yeah, I have to participate. But it's such an interesting story.
And as well, like, really, like, fundamental to her story is she was really involved in the creation of the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. So she was part of the writing of that convention, which would call the Ad Hoc Committee, but she also served on the CRPD committee and chaired that committee for a period of time. And when she was chairing that committee, she worked with CEDAW, and they wrote a position paper together on the issue of abortion. And, you know, things have been progressing since. And I think the women's movement have become more sensitive to this issue and more aware of the sensitivities and of what, you know, I suppose, you know, how life is important to everyone. That's really important, I think.
For sure. And I think it's important to kind of, it's kind of undeniable at this point that white feminism has been historically exclusionary of kind of anyone but the white, you know.
Yeah.
Anyone except like the white, heteronormative, able-bodied people.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Honestly, old school white feminists should just change their motto to, if you don't look like us, if you don't behave like us, we don't care about you. When we say white ableist feminism, that's what we mean. Read the title.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
And I think that's why it's just so important to talk about these women. In one of our classes, we were discussing kind of like the importance of oral history. And I think a lot of the time, kind of your generic history would have been extremely exclusionary as well. And I think the role of oral histories played like this a powerful, urgent role. So without them, we wouldn't have access to stories like this one or stories of minority women. And so just to kind of point that out as well.
She believes that, I suppose, the feminist movement is more, or attempting to be more inclusive of women with disabilities. Now, for example, they would be more inclusive in terms of stuff like violence against women and more open to the experiences of disabled women. And she tells a story about how in Germany, previously there was a law which meant that you had to provide evidence that you fought against a perpetrator to be considered a victim of a rape victim. So I suppose this meant that a lot of disabled women couldn't prosecute in terms of rape. But that's not only, I suppose, ableist, it's also anti-women, you know. It just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. But thankfully that law has changed. But it just shows a really vivid example of such a discriminatory law.
Yeah, I feel like people forget all the time that these laws, you know, if they were repealed, they were only repealed relatively recently. And in some countries, they're still around. Like Italy, for example, in 2016, I'm not sure if it's changed since, but if you agreed to enter a man's house, that was deemed consent. And so if a guy invited you over to his home for dinner and then raped you, because you went inside the home, you couldn't charge that man with rape. And so I think a lot of people don't realize that these laws are very much still in effect, or if they've been repealed, it's only been relatively recently. And I think people kind of need that shock factor. Like, this is still very much a problem. It still very much exists. This isn't like an issue of the past.
Yeah, I think that's definitely an important point to make. You know, I think a lot of times when we talk about these things, we do forget that they're still so prevalent in so many countries, and even in our own, there's so many there's so many avenues we don't know that are still, you would think that it's just so antiquated at this point, but it's just not the case, and it's just such a good point to bring up, Becca.
Yeah, it's frightening, really, but hopefully things are starting to change. But it is just, like Becca said, just a bit to think that these are such recent changes as well, you know, it's how they last so long. I think it is really only because of women such as Teresa and others that are really doing this kind of intersectional feminism and have been doing it for years, that it's only because of them that these rules, I suppose, have changed over time.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's, as sad as these laws are, you know, and especially the ones that are still in existence, I think it's very much fuel to continue the fight. A lot of times when we talk about this, like, first world feminism, the narrative very much is like, a lot of the problems have been solved.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some of the work that Teresa, like you've been discussing, Aoife has been doing, is saying, well, actually, no, it hasn't. And there's very much still a need for this intersectional approach and these intersectional solutions. And so I think it's just so important to remember that the fight continues. Like, the problem has not been solved.
Absolutely. And I think it's true. Like, what I've been really reflecting on in some reading is, like, everything we have today or we maybe take for granted, people have fought for in the past, you know, and it's really interesting. And I think that's why the idea of history and knowing our history is so important, especially, I suppose, for activists or people who join a movement today when things are perhaps very different to what they were some time ago. I think it's important to know and understand your history.
Yeah, definitely. There should always be an awareness and appreciation and admiration for the people who've come before you, you know, and paved the way. I think it's vital.
Yeah, and I spoke to Teresa a bit about like the disability movement and the women's movement and where I suppose she felt most at home or most welcome. And she said that she felt more accepted within the disability movement. And I suppose that this is really evident in the time that she has put into that movement. She did feel that in the women's movement, the part of her identity wasn't really understood or respected. And I suppose where she really felt most welcome or most understood was in the disabled women's group, which she was involved in, which she says isn't strong anymore, but it just shows the importance of disabled women grouping together to talk specifically about disabled women's issues. And I suppose I can reflect, I'm part of a group called Disabled Women Ireland, and I can reflect on that, and I suppose how that space is an important one for me and for other people in that group. So I think that it's really important to reignite, you know, that movement. As she said, that she believes that it's not as strong anymore. So I think it's really important to keep that movement strong and that it will strengthen, hopefully, over time. And suppose I really hope that my research as well will kind of contribute to that, can contribute to maybe the strengthening of the disabled women's movement throughout Europe.
What you had said about where she had felt, where she kind of had felt more at home, the feminist movement or disability movement, I think that really shows up the shortfalls of the feminist movement. I think it shows how far the movement has yet to go, how far it has come, I will admit, but how far absolutely it has to go.
Yeah.
And I think just that, you know, to create a safer space for women like we kind of mentioned before, who aren't, you know, able-bodied, who aren't white, who aren't middle class, you know, to kind of create a safer space, a more intersectional space that these women feel that they can, I guess, call their home, like you said.
Also, she makes really important points about, like, the importance of the women's movement and disability movement really as being strong together and not letting right wing or other or like anti-choice movement, for example, divide us or encourage us to fight each other. More disabled people or disabled women within the women's movement really would prevent this kind of othering, as she calls it, but also move away from viewing disability purely in the as a medical model kind of a view and look at it more as a social liberation movement, and social justice really is at its essence, you know, just as it is with feminism as well.
Yeah, definitely, Aoife. I think you've done a lot of justice by telling us this story about Teresa. And to your point, I think it's very revealing that she shares that she feels more comfortable in the disability circles, and yet she continues to fight to unite the women's movement and the disability movement because she sees value in the intersectionality of those two, despite maybe feeling a little isolated or ostracized by certain communities within the feminism fight. She still thinks the uniting of the two is so important. And so to Sinead's point about, you know, recognizing what we've accomplished in the past, but also very much recognizing what work needs to be done in the future. I think far too often historical achievements are used a bit as a crutch, to be honest. I think people say, well, we used to not have this and now we do. Like, look at all the progress that we've made. Look how far we've come. And I think the bits of progress that we made by no means can be used as an excuse for not furthering that progress. And it seems like that very much is the mission of Teresa, to keep pushing for that progress and to keep pushing that we can do more. And if we care about this movement, we'll want to do more.
I totally agree. And even like personally, like when on personal levels, if that argument is just so, I just can't interact with that argument. Like it used to be worse. So like that type of kind of rationale, I can't involve myself with, you know what I mean? I totally agree that it's
Used
as a crutch for sure.
And like as well, it shouldn't be used to kind of defend where we currently are or as a barrier to where we could go or where we could see ourselves, you know. So I think that's really important as well.
Sinead, to your point, like getting frustrated when someone asks those questions, right? It like brings up this idea of whose responsibility is it to engage in those conversations, you know? Because I know for me personally, when someone says like, it could be much worse, I lose energy. I don't want to engage with that. Kind of like what you were saying, Sinead. But I think in recording these podcast episodes and sharing these stories, in a way, we're taking on that role. You know, we're taking on the role of saying, okay, we will do the work and we will help educate people who believe that way, because it's work that has to be done regardless of who we decide has to do it.
Finally, just finishing up on something that stuck with me from the interview with Theresia. Theresia spoke to me a little bit about the representation of women with disabilities in power and how this is really very important, as well as in the media. But she also spoke about your presence alone and how that really has impact in terms of creating change and attitudes in the UN. So she spoke about herself, her own presence. She doesn't have arms, and she spoke about how people kind of, you know, would just never met or saw anyone who looked like her before. But she told me about one story, which she spoke about one fact, and she said that the UN, when they had the committee, the UN Committee on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, there were a number of blind people on the committee, and the United Nations website wasn't accessible at all, and people had been campaigning for years, like the blind unions, to make the UN infrastructure is accessible so they could, you know, read the information and gather information and all that. But it was only when there were people on the UN committee that they were kind of forced into a position where they had to change these structures. So I know it's something we reflected on in the last podcast as well, but just the idea of presence and how, you know, just being there makes change, makes difference. And I suppose she really finally spoke about like how important it is to encourage young women to take up these positions and move beyond their comfort zone. And I think that's something really, really important and something really nice to maybe end and reflect on, because I think it's so important that for young women to be really encouraged and supported to kind of stand up and to, you know, speak and put themselves forward for different things, and just to have the confidence to do that, but also to be supported to have the confidence. I mean, in terms of having different things that help build the confidence of people to take these positions.
Yeah, beautifully said, Aoife.
Mm-hmm.